Hello, everyone, and welcome to the RPM Rundown, a new podcast that focuses on all things logistics. I'm your host, Andrew Kamita, and I'll be taking you on this journey today as we talk about current events, we talk about the freight market, we talk about the remarketing market as well. This will be a monthly podcast, so we appreciate you joining in, and we hope that you will join in regularly as we talk about these things. Today, we have a lot of different topics to cover. We're going to talk about the Baltimore Bridge collapse. We're going to talk about vehicles stuck in ports. We're also going to talk about some nearshoring over in Mexico. Joining me today is Brian Hussman, our Vice President of Network Solutions, that's here to give us his insights as well. Welcome, Brian.
Welcome. Thank you. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Thank you for jumping on. So, as you know, a lot going on out in the world today. Now, I think talking about current events is probably something that we should start with.
Probably.
Because that's front of mind. That's what you see in the news, right? It's what gets all the headlines. You saw what happened in Baltimore, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Bridge goes down. It's very sad, obviously, but it really affects logistics in a lot of different ways. So, if we go back to March 26, when the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed, that doesn't happen very often in our modern
no,
world.
No, it does not.
Right? That's what we call a catastrophe.
Yeah.
Pete Buttigieg, the U.S. Transportation Secretary, says this has a major and protracted impact to supply chains. So based on the information you have, what you've seen in the news, Brian, what sort of impacts do you see this having on supply chains?
The Key Bridge is something that supports so much of, I believe, the northbound transportation going into the New England area. You know, it's one of the major ports on the East Coast that supports the finished vehicle logistics space. And that all comes to a halt, you know, in one fell swoop. And so what was interesting is it's not just finished vehicle logistics, right? It's not just the OEMs of automobiles. It's also a massive port when it comes to farm equipment affecting the planes, and so much more than just an automobile. And one of the things that we're trying to keep our finger on the pulse is, when is it going to open? What is the Army Corps going to do? How is that going to affect everyone else over the following months?
Obviously, we're at the point now where economically there's a point we need to move forward. We need to try to go ahead and figure out a way to, I guess, work around what's a major roadblock within the industry. And the thing is as I was kind of reading through this, and as you look at our infrastructure around the country, you don't think much about it because in most cases, everything runs exactly as it should, right? The trains are on time. The freight arrives when it's supposed to arrive. But much as it said here in this Reuters article, this bridge took 9 years to plan, 5 years to build. So a total of 14 years of production time, and it all came down in less than a minute. So it really makes you kind of realize and understand almost on the razor's edge how much our industry operates within. And it's pretty humbling to think about that. And what is the fail-safe, really? You know, when you have boats trapped in ports, when you have coal exports that no longer can make it out to ocean,
yeah,
what happens?
Just think of the infrastructure bills that are hitting and why they're so important, because if bridges do collapse, if, you know, just over time, wear and tear, people don't necessarily pay attention to why that's important to keep them up and running, because there are bottlenecks in the industry. And when that happens, everything comes to a halt.
Yeah, they really do. And I think us being in Michigan, right? I think we were ranked number one in having the best roads in the country, if I'm not mistaken.
That has to be it.
Yeah, that definitely. No, I think that was actually the opposite. I'm pretty sure Alaska has nicer roads than we do. And the thing is, especially as like the trucks as equipment.
That was a joke, right?
Oh, 100%. Got it,
got it. Okay.
I mean, have you driven here lately? I can hear the machines outside the office right now tearing the street up.
Yeah.
And in 2 years, I'll have to do it again. But, you know, when you look at the way that.
Year and a half, not two.
Yeah, that's true. 18 months is usually,
you
know, usually pretty good. But, you know, even when you look at the infrastructure report card that's put together by the Department of Transportation, it really makes me wonder how as a company and how as an industry we can almost plan for the worst case scenario. Because according to the Department of Transportation's infrastructure report card, did you know that existed?
I've heard.
Yeah, everybody reads it, right? But 7.5% of all U.S. overpasses, all bridges in the United States that service road freight, cars, trucks, etc., are deemed structurally deficient.
Well, that's terrifying.
Which means that they're in very poor shape. And those are all ones that were built less than 50 years ago. That's 46,154 bridges servicing 178 million cars and trucks every single day. So you think about a major artery, a major bridge like the one in Baltimore, and obviously that wasn't due to design error. That was due to obviously, you know, a collision with a boat or a freighter. But especially when you look at logistical networks, much like the ones that we contribute to, you know, what are some ways that you think companies like us can try to plan for that worst case scenario?
That's a fantastic question. And I think because no one can expect it, no one can plan for these catastrophic events, right? So being that we don't have an asset, right, we are partnering with thousands of carriers across the country so that at any given time when there is variability, inconsistency, we can help the shipping partners that we are working with capitalize and really streamline where variability takes place.
Yeah.
Simply put, right? So if there is a catastrophic moment and there needs to be help or there needs to be a reaction to it, you know, it could be maybe instead of the Key Bridge or the Baltimore port, maybe it needs to go down to Savannah, or it needs to go further north and we need to react and provide logistics help down there, we can, right? And I think that is one of the things that we're trying to focus on right now is where are things going to change? What areas of the country need help? And then we actually start sending vehicles or sending trucks there to help move that freight.
I think execution is really the big thing with that. And do you have a team that's ready to execute the plan along with you?
Yeah.
And I think we've spent a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of resources really building a strong curated network that can support in situations like 100%. This. Especially when you look at OEM vehicles where there's very high standards, where there's very high expectations in terms of not only how they're transported, but the expediency and the level of care that's taken. So to be able to reallocate and reroute many of those carriers that can perform to that level all into one area all at the same time is really no small feat.
No, and this catastrophic event is awful. It's horrible. The economy has continued to see one catastrophic event after another over the years. We've seen it from chips. We've seen it from, you know, the railroads not being able to move, you name it. And the ability to pivot and move towards that complexity, I think, is really what the environment today is requiring.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to look at it. Now, obviously, we just discussed a situation that you really can't plan for.
Of course.
It's sudden, it's catastrophic, but let's talk about a situation currently going on that you can plan for.
Okay.
Right? Because it's one that hasn't necessarily come to resolution yet, but it will in the very near future. And I'm talking about Volkswagen cars that have been blocked by U.S. Customs over a international part that did not or possibly may have violated labor laws. So this is out of VOA News, but it says that there are tens of thousands of vehicles currently stuck at ports all across the country with really no timetable as to when they might be released. But I'm willing to bet that when they all get the okay, whether the chips are all changed out and whether it's portioned out into the market or whether it's just a major dump of vehicles, it's going to be a free-for-all trying to get people out there to move those.
Yeah, 100%. And again, it's one more economic catastrophe, right? It's no different than the chips. Like I was saying before, it's no different than there's this constraint on supply or constraint on demand, or there's not enough carriers to move that supply, right? Again, if the border is closed or if the border isn't able to move the rail cars, it's the exact same thing, right? We could remember back about a decade ago when spinach and strawberries and E. coli happened in California, and instantly that market switched overnight, where there were carriers stranded in California because no more produce. And now everyone needed to go to Florida to pick up their spinach and strawberries, right? Like, you can't plan for this stuff, right? And there are some things that we can plan for, But how do we start working with the partner carriers and these shippers to understand it's going to happen? Because we can see the news, these tariffs are still going to be a topic. And this is probably not going to be the only time a vehicle or sets of vehicles are going to be stopped because of these tariffs that are being enforced. So how can we start working with the shippers to understand what are these contingency plans and start moving the carriers and their fleets into the appropriate positions to help?
Yeah. Now, you talk about tariffs. You talk about having to be strategic and planning for future capacity needs. Mm-hmm. If you can kind of tell me a little bit, and really everyone who's listening on the podcast here, what is one of the really unique aspects of your position specifically?
Well, part of my role and part of my role is we're building out Mexico, right? So there's some cross-border movements that naturally take place. We need to start having better understanding of those tariffs. How does that affect us? We also understand just what's going on in the news from BYD, just really competing with Tesla at a whole new level, and companies trying to emerge into the Mexico markets, understanding that Mexico is looking to boom in the next 3 to 5 years on all scales. It's not just moving finished vehicle logistics, but production parts, aftermarket parts, agriculture, food and beverage, you name it. It's going to boom and it's going to blow up.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny because I know back before when we were in the planning stages of doing this first podcast episode, the articles and some of the ones that we're going to reference here in the next few minutes, we already had those kind of on deck and ready to go. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you have such hands-on experience with it is, I think, a really unique perspective. And the buzzword, so to speak, around what you're talking about is nearshoring.
Yeah.
Right. That's kind of the new hot word in all the articles. And this is a really interesting one from the CME Group, you know, the Mercantile Exchange out of Chicago. And Ivan Castano has got some really interesting takes on nearshoring and some really interesting data that I think us as a non-asset based carrier really need to kind of keep in mind, right, in terms of how we look at opportunities. So obviously the old NAFTA, right, or the current USMCA agreement allows tariff-free trade across the border with Mexico as well as with Canada. And last year in 2023, Mexico actually passed China as the largest importer to the United States. Currently, as of right now, 15% of total U.S. imports come from Mexico. I'll be honest, that was very surprising to me when I read it because I was trying to think, like, you know, outside of obviously a lot of agriculture, I know that, you know, my kids love berries.
Yeah.
And we go through way too many of them. But on the package, it's always grown in Mexico. And the quality is really high. And it's amazing how long they last in the fridge. But that's just a very small subset. And I think I hear you around the office singing the Avocados from Mexico jingle.
Naturally, all the time. As well. All the time.
It's just so catchy. But yeah, there's so much coming into the country, right? And you would think that, especially as the economy has down there, as there is that investment. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about, I guess, where you might see additional opportunities?
It is something that is fascinating, intriguing, that even in the last handful of months, just the news of the strength of the peso as it's hitting all-time highs over the last handful of years that we haven't seen for almost a decade, right? The investments that are taking place that are reaching all-time highs that are putting them many times top of the list globally when it comes to investments and liabilities, which is fantastic. Where in the past, different pockets of the country were really well known for technology or food and beverage or automotive or just manufacturing. And now there is just growth sectors of new companies just growing and popping up in other areas that aren't just those hubs of technology. There are new bridges being built. There's new roads being built where before that infrastructure just didn't exist or was not good enough.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that we truly expect over the next 3 to 5 years, which shouldn't be a shock for anyone, that it's just going to continue to blow up. The real question is, with all of the change with, let's say, the carte-à-porter and everything like that going on, and the infrastructure, the digital infrastructure that the governments are willing to put in place, how is that going to affect the trade? As everyone's booming, there's, you know, 2x, 3x, 5x of the economy that's trying to be grown and that much more volume. Are the governments willing to put in that much effort into the infrastructure to make sure the customs is flowing and doesn't shut down?
Well, that's a really key part of it. And it's funny you mentioned that, right? I'm getting a little ahead of my article list here. But according to payments.com, there's currently actually a monopolization probe going on down in Mexico, which I think is a really great proactive thing that the government is stepping in and doing, because the government is pursuing very ambitious plans to expand specifically its road and railway infrastructure. So it would seem that they are going ahead and really taking a very serious approach to wanting to be a very major producer and very major player in the game. And when you look at some of the big projects that are coming down the pipe, and again, according to the very same CME article that we were referencing earlier, there's a big focus on EV, electric vehicle investments happening down within the confines of Mexico. For instance, Tesla announced plans to build a $5 billion factory in Monterrey, which is a huge burgeoning financial hub down in Mexico. BMW intends to set up an 800 million euro at this point, about $850 million EV battery factory. You have Bosch out of Germany spending over $250 million on a brake plant. BMW, Nissan, Samsung, all of them are earmarking funds to produce things down in Mexico. And all with the idea of what? Obviously supplying it to the local markets, but also the United States. Mm-hmm. I think economically it would make a lot of sense. So, from a company like us, how do you go ahead and prepare for an influx into Mexico? Is that even something we can task onto?
That's a big can to open up. But I think what I would want to really focus in on is it's going to happen, right? And so what we are really latching onto and really exploring and working to grow into is, what are the areas of need of the different partners that we have made, and how can we help them, right? And so what do I mean by that? Because that's kind of vague. Is there's going to be variability that takes place. Think building materials, right? Different environmental factor or different the products that go on those building materials, and what is it, flatbeds? Right? Different kinds of flatbeds. You're like, well, what does that have to do with vehicles? Well, those same flatbeds, you know, could probably be used to move the vehicles out of Mexico too. So now there's a constraint. Well, what happens to the traditional users of those flatbed vehicles, right? Other farming equipment to construction materials that are traditionally using it, right? There's this constraint. Well, we're not building that many new flatbed trailers. And so people are going to have to get creative on what their supply chain looks like. And there's going to be this ripple effect. But step one is, let's start having those conversations with those shippers, knowing that those constraints are going to hit the market, because that constraint from the flatbed market is then going to affect the constraint of the dry van market, which is then going to have this ripple effect. And it's not just moving the finished products. It's now all of the production materials that are going to be required, right? Is the supply and demand market that supports all of that going to need to be bolstered? Probably. So now the infrastructure, right? And it just keeps on, these dominoes start falling, and there's this ripple effect of, we believe that just by the efforts of in our relationships that we know, that we just start injecting ourselves and knowing that we run to that complexity, that there's definitely opportunity. We're excited for that.
Yeah. And I think that in a lot of cases, RPM is almost ahead of the curve in a lot of ways, as we're trying to build out our carrier network within Mexico and having carriers that are, you know, if we look at our Canadian model, right, those that are fast certified, that can run cross-border moves and get freight, you know, in a multi-destination, multi-country kind of way. But I wonder if, as you talk about kind of the constraints on capacity, I wonder if that will move I should say feeding that capacity will move as quickly as the investments that are happening in Mexico. Because you look at BYD, for instance, you mentioned them earlier, right? They are very, very serious about setting up an automotive plant in Mexico. Their CEO, Stella Lee, she has made multiple appearances down there. She's very open to finding a location because she wants to build very inexpensive EVs for that market, which at some point you would think that they would end up in the United States. And if you look at the Alliance for American Manufacturing, they're actually calling on the government to try to step in and create boundaries and rules about this company that's entered the market with this really inexpensive vertical integration type of network. They're saying that them building vehicles in Mexico would lead to an extinction level event for the U.S. auto sector.
Interesting.
So I find it interesting that we look at that as an opportunity. It's parts, it's vehicles. Someone's got to move it. And we're getting ahead of the game on trying to develop a network around it, right? In your perspective and your time spent down in Mexico and working specifically on this, what are some of the challenges that you've really ran into in trying to kind of procure a network, and how have we kind of overcome that?
Really, at the end of the day, making sure that the experience that they have is what they are looking for and that we pay attention to it is actually the number one thing that we've been focusing on, because without it, you don't have a network, you don't have a close connection. And what we found is that when we focused on that, the network just grew. It grew naturally, and it's grown quite quickly.
That's good.
That's it. It's not more than that.
It's not complex. It's just doing what works.
The simple things well.
Yeah.
Right. It's just the fundamentals. Do what you say you're going to do.
Blocking and tackling.
That's all it is.
Yeah. No, that's perfect. And, you know, I'm going to kind of shift focus a little bit because you kind of sparked an idea that I had here. And I want to shift into the remarketing space a little bit. And you talk about, you know, carrier onboarding and really kind of finding the right people. We found, especially in the remarketing space, the need is so drastically different. It almost changes month to month, right? You have your post-recovery transport where it's full truckload, needs to go to auction, but also you have singles that need to go everywhere as well. And especially with fluctuating prices, there just seems this volatility within the remarketing space where, as you mentioned, making sure we have the right network, that we have people that are invested in doing the job correctly, and having them in the right place at the right time is very important because when you look at the remarketed side where prices are fluctuating, where the demand for vehicles is changing almost by the month, well, sometimes, you know, if you're buying a Yukon XL, the quantity of vehicles that are moving there is very different than a Nissan Versa.
Yeah.
Right. And depending on the mileage and depending on the destination, you know, it's really been an interesting experience trying to kind of plug and play the right partner with the right opportunity. But here's the way I kind of see it is when you look at vehicles on a wholesale level, there's been price decreases year over year, which is great for the individuals buying it wholesale. But you and I don't buy it wholesale and we haven't really seen a big change. I wish we did though. I actually just had to buy a car. So finally found one after months of searching. And to me, it's mind-boggling what vehicles cost today. We looked at new vehicles. We looked at lightly used vehicles. We looked at some more used vehicles.
And then did it again.
Super used.
Over and over and over again.
It just, you know, and even you look at, we bought our last vehicle 4 years ago. Not the one we're replacing. But prices, interest rates, everything was so different. And you see now, especially where dealer groups, wholesalers, they're able to grab these vehicles out of auction, et cetera, at year over year, considerably great prices, right? That's not getting passed on to the end consumer, but that gives, I think, remarketers a really, and when I say remarketer, we're talking about a dealership, we're talking about a fleet company, you know, somebody that's going to procure a used vehicle to turn around and sell it to an end user. It gives them a really good opportunity to kind of expand their geographic search almost because there's so much variability between all the different auctions and prices seem to be all over the place. And I guess I just start thinking about, you know, what are really the needs and wants and how does that remarketer How does that business kind of plug transport into the equation to make sure it's a profitable venture to search outside of their comfort zone?
Okay. I think my first thought is they should include transportation into that equation. And if not, they're probably missing something. And what I mean by that is we understand that as much as there might have been a decrease in wholesale cost, to the end user, it's probably not, they're probably not experiencing that value between looking at what the cost of a new vehicle is versus a three-year-old vehicle. They're not seeing that gap like they expect.
It almost seems the same, right? as it's always been.
So for these buyers to get consumers to buy used vehicles, they need to squeeze as much margin, as much profit as they can.
Yeah.
And so we know that, well, just say an F-150 or a 1500 truck, it sells for a higher rate out of one region, and the ability to buy it out of a different region and transport it at as cheap a cost as possible while still getting the value from the transporters is advantageous for them, right? But the ability to have that real-time dynamic pricing where they can try to understand, can I take advantage of a low cost here on the vehicle, get a low cost on the transportation, and try to maximize their profit, is happening now more and more, especially with APIs and digital integrations and all of these things. It is something that these wholesalers are now asking for more and more. Mm-hmm. And the ability to have a breadth of a network that is not just focused on moving a vehicle or a truck. I need to load a truck from Detroit, Chicago, Chicago back.
Right.
Right. Being that we don't own assets, we're a non-asset logistics provider or a 3PL, right? We can say, yeah, we have a provider that can fit that need. Oh, you need to go instead to Kansas City or St. Louis or Dallas or whatever it may be, but give dynamic pricing in real time so that they're at the digital auction saying, I want that. And they buy, nope, ignore, buy. Like that's when it gets exciting because then what's happening in Baltimore doesn't affect it as much, right?
It's true, yeah.
They can take advantage of the variability across the entire country.
Yeah, and I think that there's still a huge room to grow.
Of course.
With that. Because look, I mean, we have in our business, we have our freight side of our business, mm-hmm. which is really how we were founded and how we started. And we also have our vehicle side of the business. And the difference in technology, the difference in industry standards between the two, there's a pretty big chasm, right? Yeah. Between the two, you know, freight is appointment based. It's very technologically advanced. Vehicles getting there, but it's not there yet. And I think that especially the remarketers that can kind of figure out how to almost want to say game the system a little bit, right? Kind of get that proprietary data on, you know, wholesale costs, have that real time, you know, quoting when it comes to, you know, having your transportation partner. And I think, I know on our end, we've invested a lot in our, you know, IT infrastructure to be able to support a lot of these initiatives. But I think that's really, as a remarketer, kind of how you get ahead of the game and make sure you're maximizing those profit margins, but also being able to offer a very competitive and competitively priced product to that end user as well.
100%.
Yeah, I mean, it's I see it as more of a, you know, kind of a national shift. And one that's probably going to continue on going forward. Because I don't know about, do you think prices are really going to change that much from where they are right now, at least on the wholesale level?
So it's the supply and demand is really going to be the only thing that really shifts it.
Yeah.
So if we do start getting more vehicles mm-hmm. out of an unexpected area, let's say Mexico.
Yeah.
And it does start shifting supply and demand and consumers feel that they can start buying mm-hmm. Different quantities or different varieties and their consumer habits start to change.
Yeah.
Like those type of, I'm not going to get into all of economies and all that stuff, but generally speaking, when you have a free market, that changes prices,
mm-hmm.
right?
Sure.
And if there isn't that market and there isn't that variation, mm-hmm. then maybe they don't shift as quickly.
Yeah. And again, I'm a little biased,
sure.
only a little bit, but working specifically on remarketing. And the thing that I really love about the remarketing industry specifically is it's always, I don't want to call it predictable because it really isn't, but you have OEM business that's very spot. It's very at the moment. There's planned production figures, and those may happen. Those may not happen. Things change, sure. Right? But the remarketed business is what I like to call almost like a giant lagging indicator to what the OEM business does. So when you think about back during, the COVID era, I guess as we'll call it, that 1 to 2 year period where production volumes shrank on the OEM side by over 2 million cars a year, we're still seeing decreased lease turn-ins. We're still seeing fewer remarketed vehicles enter the market right now, which of course is what's inflating prices to a large degree. And we're not really expecting things to start to normalize again until closer to the end of 2025, start of 2026. So it's kind of interesting how, you know, as someone who works in remarketing, you can almost plan ahead and you can kind of almost look at that aggregate data on the OEM side and say, okay, I know that in 24 to 36 months, here's probably what's going to happen. And you can arrange your network and you can talk to your transport partner and you can say, hey, here's what I want to do. How do we get it done together?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think one thing that tends to happen, just human nature, is we get used to a certain habit. We get used to certain trends. And even if it's something we used to do, you know, years ago, 3, 4, 5 years ago, right? If we get to 2025 and things haven't changed, it'll be half a decade. And there's going to be new people in these roles and there's turnover. There's going to be a lot of knowledge that is lost inherently.
Yeah.
And just how can we, again, run to that complexity, have that those conversations and just generate that experience? Yes, I'd like us to bring technology, dynamic pricing that is in real time.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, I want to have those conversations with these shippers. But I'd actually encourage any, if you're a shipper, go have those conversations with your trusted providers, because we got used to a certain market and that market's going to change.
Would agree entirely. And I think it's not just the market that's going to change. I think it's also the product is changing too. Mm-hmm. So last topic I want to cover here on our podcast today. And I'll start with a very important question. And I think this is really probably the one that, I mean, it's top of the list easily. Do you see yourself as somebody who aspires to own an electric vehicle?
I actually own an electric vehicle.
Do you really? What do you have?
I have a Ford Lightning.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
You like it?
Love it. It's fantastic.
Did you have an F-150 before?
I've driven one before, but no, I did not.
Okay. Do you find it very easy to live with? Really no different than?
Once you get everything set up, then it's just like plugging in a phone.
Plug and play, nice and easy.
The energy companies make it fairly simple, readjust how you do it. I had to fill up a gas tank the other day and I was like, whoa, this is wild.
Almost forgot how it works.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Reason I ask, so as you know, obviously, I was recently appointed to the EV Readiness Committee through mm-hmm. the IARA.
Yeah.
And we talk about EVs a lot. And I think that many of the different manufacturers out there have varying, I guess, thoughts on how impactful or how widespread EV adoption will be. But the reality is that electric vehicles are entering the marketplace at least an abbreviated rate. When I look at it from a transport perspective, EVs are heavier.
Yeah.
Center of gravity is very different. And when we look at the weight limits that many of the trailers and whatnot and the laws around those are accustomed to, sometimes it pushes the envelope a little bit when it comes to load factor as they get integrated into shipments with other types of vehicles. Yeah. We talk about being dynamic. We talk about being flexible. You know, what would your recommendation be to any of our listeners on how to properly utilize a transport partner to make sure that they're set up for the transition to EVs within their fleets?
So the conversations that I would have and recommend is, let's first start with, when something goes wrong, are we prepared, right? Generally speaking, battery runs out of juice. Are we prepped to jump that battery?
It's a little bit different than getting a key cut, right?
It is. So much more of the component. Like, there's not as many moving parts, but everything is some kind of revolves around technology, electronics, mm-hmm. electric, right? And so how do you deal with the vehicle when it's run out of juice? Like, that would be the number one thing, because if you can't move it, if you can't get it out of gear, quote unquote, you can't do anything with it. Are you just going to rip it off the back of the trailer? That's not great. So that is one of the bigger problems that happens, especially if you're going longer hauls, mm-hmm. right? That is a big concern. The wear and tear on certain parts of those trailers, just having so much weight some of those axles is huge, right? If it's larger stingers, the pistons and the ramps, like those type of moving parts are going to have more wear and tear. Like normally you're not, if you're moving a 1500 truck, it's going to be a 4,300, 4,500, 4,600 sure. pounds. You start moving a 1500 style EV vehicle, it's another 30, 40% of the weight that's added to it.
Well, did you see the dry weight of the Hummer? That's a really cool vehicle, by the way. 9,300 pounds.
It's heavy.
That's wild.
It's real heavy.
You're fitting three of those on a Stinger.
So people might not be used to moving, you know, dualies and 3,500s and 4,500 type vehicles. That's essentially what you're doing.
Right.
So number one issue is what happens when the vehicle's dead. Number two is wear and tear on the parts. It's going to be tires. It's going to be brakes. It's going to be in areas that you're not used to.
Yeah.
And just think through it. Like what happens when something happens?
Yeah. And right? I would think having newer equipment is almost paramount.
Yeah. I can't tell you. I'm not a truck driver, but what the conversations I have had with these different drivers that are moving this is that it's a little nerve-wracking.
Can imagine right. So.
And so have a little grace
yeah.
with these providers because everyone's in the same spot.
Yeah. Well, I encourage, and I know you do as well, yeah. obviously foresight and planning, because it's not just the equipment type, the equipment age. It's also making sure the insurance is in line
sure.
to cover, you know, higher value vehicles with EVs, things like that. So definite word of recommendation to make sure you're working with your transport yeah. partner to plan for that type of transition.
Yeah. Check the battery before you load it.
That too.
That would be my number one. That's what I would say. Check the battery. And if it is in a bad spot.
You know, it does make me wonder though. So you know how like when a brand new vehicle comes off the line, they put like the splash of fuel in it mm-hmm. and they're driving onto the
splash
rail car.
Electricity.
Onto the, yeah. How charged is that battery coming out of the factory?
I think I heard once 15, 20% max.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Check the battery.
Good word of advice from Brian Hussman.
Yeah.
Brian, thank you so much for joining
us. Absolutely, anytime.
And thank you for joining us on this episode of the RPM Rundown podcast. Make sure to follow us on our social channels at RPM Moves. And if you like what you heard today, make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Take care.